the latter's reputation. Both knew all too well that modern opinion on Mangal Pandey weighed in on either side of two camps. An unrecognized hero, Samad Iqbal, A.S. Misra. A palaver over nothing, Mickey, Majid and Millat, Alsana, Archie, Irie, Clarence and Denzel, British scholarship from 1857 to the present day. Again and again, he had argued the toss with Archie over this issue. Over the years, they had sat in O'Connell's and returned to the same debate, sometimes with new information gleaned from Samad's continual research into the matter. But ever since Archie found out the truth about Pandey, circa 1953, there was no changing his mind. Pandey's only claim to fame, as Archie was at pains to point out, was his etymological gift to the English language by way of the word pandy, under which title in the OED, the curious reader will find the following definition. Pandy, the surname of the first mutineer amongst the high-caste sepoys in the Bengal army. 1. Any sepoy who revolted in the Indian mutiny of 1857-59. 2. Any mutineer or traitor. 3. Any fool or coward in a military situation.
Plain as the pie on your face, my friend.
And here, Archie would close the book with an exultant slam.
And I don't need a dictionary to tell me that. But then neither do you. It's common parlance. When you and me were in the army, same. You tried to put one over me once. But the truth will out, mate. Pandy only ever meant one thing. If I were you, I'd start playing down the family connection rather than bending everybody's ear 24 hours a bloody day.
Archibald, just because the word exists, it does not follow that it is a correct representation of the character of Mangal Pandey. The first definition we agree on. My great-grandfather was a mutineer, and I am proud to say this. I concede matters did not go quite according to plan, but traitor? Coward? The dictionary you show me is old. These definitions are now out of currency. Pandey was no traitor and no coward.
Ah, now, you see, we've been through this. And my thought is this. There's no smoke without fire,
Archie would say, looking impressed by the wisdom of his own conclusion.
Know what I mean?
This was one of Archie's preferred analytic tools when confronted with news stories, historical events, and the tricky day-to-day process of separating fact from fiction. There's no smoke without fire. There was something so vulnerable in the way he relied on this conviction that Samad had never had the heart to disabuse him of it. Why tell an old man that there can be smoke without fire, as surely as there are deep wounds that draw no blood?
Of course I see your point of view, Archie, I do. But my point is, and has always been, from the very first time we discussed the subject, my point is that this is not the full story. And yes, I realize that we have several times thoroughly investigated the matter, but the fact remains. Full stories are as rare as honesty, precious as diamonds. If you are lucky enough to uncover one, a full story will sit on your brain like lead. They are difficult. They are long-winded. They are epic. They are like the stories God tells, full of impossibly particular information. You don't find them in the dictionary.
All right, Professor. Let's hear your version.
Often you see old men in the corner of dark pubs, discussing and gesticulating, using beer mugs and sword cellars to represent long-dead people and far-off places. At that moment, they display a vitality missing in every other area of their lives. They light up, unpacking a full story onto the table. Here is Churchill Fork. Over there is Czechoslovakia Serviette. Here we find the accumulation of German troops represented by a collection of cold peas. They are reborn. But when Archie and Samad had these tabletop debates during the 80s, knives and forks were not enough. The whole of the steamy Indian summer of 1857, the whole of that year of mutiny and massacre would be hauled into O'Connell's and brought to semi-consciousness by these two makeshift historians. The area stretching from the jukebox to the fruit machine became Delhi. Viv Richards silently complied as Pandey's English superior, Captain Hearsay. Clarence and Denzel continued to play dominoes while simultaneously being cast as the restless sepoy hordes of the British Army. Each man brought the pieces of his argument, laid them out, and assembled them for the other to see. Scenes were set, parts of bullets traced, disagreement reigned. According to the legend, during the spring of 1857, in a factory in Dumdum, a new kind of British bullet went into production. Designed to be used in English guns by Indian soldiers, like most bullets at the time, they had a casing that must be bitten in order to fit the barrel. There seemed nothing exceptional about them until it was discovered by some canny factory worker that they were covered in a grease made from the fat of pigs, monstrous to Muslims, and the fat of cows, sacred to Hindus. It was an innocent mistake, as far as anything is innocent on stolen land, an infamous British blunder. But what a feverish turmoil must have engulfed the people on first hearing the news. Under the specious pretext of new weaponry, the English were intending to destroy their caste, their honor, their standing in the eyes of gods and men, everything, in short, that made life worth living. A rumor like this could not be kept secret. It spread like wildfire through the dry lands of India that summer, down the production line, out onto the streets, through townhouses and country shacks, through barrack after barrack, until the whole country was ablaze with the desire for a mutiny. The rumor reached the large, unsightly ears of Mangal Pandey, an unknown sepoy in the small town of Barrackpore, who swaggered into his parade ground, 29th March 1857, stepping forward from the throng to make a certain kind of history.
"Make a fool of himself, more like," Archie will say,
for these days he does not swallow Pandeyology as gullibly as he once did.
"You totally misunderstand his sacrifice," Samad will reply.
"What sacrifice? He couldn't even kill himself properly." "The problem with you, Sam, is you won't listen to the evidence. I've read up on it all. The truth is the truth, no matter how nasty it may taste."
"Really? Well, please, my friend, since you are apparently an expert in the doings of my family, please enlighten me. Let us hear your version."
Now, the average school student nowadays is aware of the complex forces, movements, and deep currents that motivate wars and spark revolutions. But when Archie was in school, the world seemed far more open to its own fictionalization. History was a different business then, taught with one eye on narrative, the other on drama, no matter how unlikely or chronologically inaccurate. According to this schema, the Russian Revolution began because everyone hated Rasputin. The Roman Empire declined and fell because Antony was having it off with Cleopatra. Henry V triumphed at Agincourt because the French were too busy admiring their own outfits. And the great Indian mutiny of 1857 began when a drunken fool called Mangal Pandey shot a bullet. Despite Samad's opposition, each time Archie read the following, he found himself more convinced. The scene is Barrackpore. The date 29th March 1857. It is Sunday afternoon,
but on the dusty floor of the parade ground, a drama is being enacted, which is suggestive of anything but Sabbath peace. There chatters and sways and eddies a confused mass of sepoys, in all stages of dress and undress, some armed, some unarmed, but all fermenting with excitement. Some 30 yards in front of the line of the 34th, swaggers to and fro a sepoy named Mangal Pandey. He is half drunk with bhang, and wholly drunk with religious fanaticism. Chin in air, loaded musket in hand, he struts backwards and forwards, at a sort of half-dance, shouting in shrill and nasal monotone, "Come out, you blackguards! Turn out, all of you! The English are upon us! Through biting these cartridges, we shall all be made infidels!" The man, in fact, is in that condition of mingled bhang and nerves, which makes a Malay run amok, and every shout from his lips runs like a sudden flame through the brains and along the nerves of the listening crowd of fellow sepoys as the crowd gets bigger, the excitement more intense. A human powder magazine, in a word, is about to explode. And explode it did. Pandey shot at his lieutenant and missed him. Then he took out a large sword, a talwar, and cowardly lunged while his lieutenant's back was turned, catching him on the shoulder. A sepoy tried to restrain him, but Pandey battled on. Then came reinforcements. One Captain Hearsay rushed forward, his son at his side, both armed and honorable and prepared to die for their country.
"Hearsay is precisely what it is. Rubbish! Fabrication!"
At which point, Pandey saw the game was up, pointed his enormous gun at his own head, and dramatically pulled the trigger with his left foot. He missed. A few days later, Pandey stood trial and was found guilty. From the other side of the country, on a chaise longue in Delhi, his execution was ordered by one General Henry Havelock, a man honored, much to Samad's fury, by a statue just outside the palace restaurant, Trafalgar Square, to the right of Nelson, who added, in a postscript to his written instruction, that he did hope that this would put an end to all the rash talk of mutiny one kept hearing recently. But it was too late. As Pandey swung in the sultry breeze, hanging from a makeshift gallows, his disbanded comrades from the 34th were heading for Delhi, determined to join the rebel forces of what was to become one of the bloodiest failed mutinies of this or any century. This version of events, by a contemporary historian named Fitchett, was enough to send Samad into spasms of fury. When a man has nothing but his blood to commend him, each drop of it matters, matters terribly. It must be jealously defended. It must be protected against assailants and detractors. It must be fought for. But, like a Chinese whisper, Fitchett's intoxicated, incompetent Pandey had passed down a line of subsequent historians, the truth mutating, bending, receding as the whisper continued. It didn't matter that bhang, a hemp drink taken in small doses for medicinal purposes, was extremely unlikely to cause intoxication of this kind, or that Pandey, a strict Hindu, was extremely unlikely to drink it. It didn't matter that Samad could find not one piece of corroborating evidence that Pandey had taken bhang that morning. The story still clung, like a gigantic misquote, to the Iqbal reputation, as solid and seemingly irremovable as the misconception that Hamlet ever said he knew Yorick well.
"Enough! It makes no difference how many times you read these things to me, Archibald."
Archie usually came armed with a plastic bag full of Brent library books, anti-Pandey propaganda, misquotes galore.
"It is like a gang of children caught with their hands in an enormous honey jar. They are all going to tell me the same lie. I am not interested in this kind of slander. I am not interested in puppet theater or tragic farce. Action interests me, friend.
And here, Samad would mime the final zipping up of his lips, the throwing away of a key.
True action, not words. I tell you, Archibald, Mangal Pandey sacrificed his life in the name of justice for India. Not because he was intoxicated or insane.
Pass me the ketchup. It was the 1989 New Year's Eve shift in O'Connell's, and the debate was in full swing.
True, he was not a hero in the way you in the West like your heroes. He did not succeed, except in the manner of his honorable death. But imagine it. There he sat.
Samad pointed to Denzel, about to play his winning domino, at the trial, knowing death was upon him,
refusing ever to reveal the names of his fellow conspirators.
Now that,
said Archie, patting his pile of skeptics, Michael Edwards, P.J. O'Taylor, Sayyid Moinul Haq and the rest, depends what you read.
No, Archie, that is a common mistake. The truth does not depend on what you read. Please let us not go into the nature of truth. Then you do not have to draw with my cheese and I can avoid eating your chalk.
All right then. Pandey, what did he achieve? Nothing. All he did was start a mutiny. But too early, mind, before the agreed date. And excuse my French, but that's a fucking disaster in military terms.
You plan.
You don't act on instinct.
He caused unnecessary casualties, English and Indian.
With respect, I don't believe that to be the case.
Well, you're wrong.
With respect, I believe I am right.
It's like this, Sam. Imagine here.
He gathered a pile of dirty plates that Mickey was about to put in the dishwasher.
Are all the people who have written about your Pandey in the last 100 and whatever years. Now, here's the ones that agree with me.
He placed 10 plates on his side of the table and pushed one over to Samad.
And that's the madman on your side.
A. S. Misra, respected Indian civil servant, not a madman.
Right, well, it would take you at least another 100 and whatever years to get as many plates as I have. Even if you were going to make them all yourself, the likelihood is, once you had them, no bugger will want to eat off them anyway. Metaphorically speaking, know what I mean?
Which left only A.S. Misra. One of Samad's nephews, Rajnu, had written to him in the spring of 81 from his Cambridge college, mentioning casually that he had found a book which might be of some interest to his uncle. In it, he said, could be found an eloquent defense of their shared ancestor, one Mangal Pandey. The only surviving copy was in his college library. It was by a man named Misra.
Had he heard of it already? If not, might it not serve, Rajnu added in a cautious P.S., as a pleasant excuse to see his uncle again?
Samad arrived on the train the very next day and stood on the platform, warmly greeting his soft-spoken nephew in the pouring rain, shaking his hand several times and talking as if it were going out of fashion.
A great day,
he repeated over and over until both men were soaked to the skin.
A great day for our family, Rajnu. A great day for the truth.
Wet men not being allowed in college libraries, they spent the morning drying off in a stuffy upstairs cafe, full of the right type of ladies having the right type of tea. Rajnu, ever the good listener, sat patiently as his uncle babbled wildly. Oh, the importance of the discovery! Oh, how long he had waited for this moment! Nodding in all the right places and smiling sweetly as Samad brushed tears from the corners of his eyes.
It is a great book, isn't it, Rajnu?
Asked Samad pleadingly, as his nephew left a generous tip for the sour-faced waitress, who did not appreciate overexcited Indians spending 3 hours over one cream tea and leaving wet prints all over the furniture.
It is recognized, isn't it?
Rajneesh knew in his heart that the book was an inferior, insignificant, forgotten piece of scholarship. But he loved his uncle. So he smiled, nodded, and smiled firmly again. Once in the library, Samad was asked to fill in the visitor's book. Name, Samad Mia Iqbal. College, educated elsewhere, Delhi. Research project, truth. Rajnu, tickled by this last entry, picked up the pen, adding, and tragedy.
Truth and tragedy,
said a deadpan librarian, turning the book back round.
Any particular kind?
Don't worry, said Samad genially. We'll find it.
It took a stepladder to reach it, but it was well worth the stretch. When Rajnu passed the book to his uncle, Samad felt his fingers tingle and, looking at its cover, shape and color, saw that it was all he had dreamt of. It was heavy, many-paged, bound in a tan leather and covered in the light dust that denotes something incredibly precious, something rarely touched.
I left a marker in it. There is much to read, but there is something I thought you'd like to see first,
said Rajnu, laying it down on a desk. The heavy thud of one side of the book hit the table and Samad looked at the appointed page. It was more than he could have hoped for.
It's only an artist's impression, but the similarity between...
Don't speak,
said Samad, tracing his fingers across the picture.
This is our blood, Rajnu. I never thought I would see. What eyebrows! What a nose! I have his nose.
You have his face, uncle. More dashing, naturally.
And what does it say underneath? Damn, where are my reading glasses? Read it for me, Rajnu. It is too small.
The caption. Mangal Pandey fired the first bullet of the 1857 movement. His self-sacrifice gave the siren to the nation to take up arms against an alien ruler, culminating in a mass uprising with no parallel in world history. Though the effort failed in its immediate consequences, it succeeded in laying the foundations of the independence to be won in 1947. For his patriotism, he paid with his life. But until his last breath, he refused to disclose the names of those who were preparing for and instigating the great uprising.
Samad sat down on the bottom rung of the stepladder and wept.
So, let me get this straight. Now you're telling me that without Pandey, there'd be no Gandhi. That without your mad granddad, there'd be no bloody independence.
Great granddad.
No, let me finish, Sam. Is that what you're seriously asking us?
Archie clapped an uninterested Clarence and Denzel on the back.
To believe? Do you believe it?
He asked Clarence.
Me can't believe that, said Clarence,
having no idea of the topic. Denzel blew his nose into a napkin.
Truth be told, me not like to believe anything. Hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil. That my motto. He was the tickle in the sneeze, Archibald. It is as simple as that. I do believe that.
There was quiet for a minute. Archibald watched three sugar cubes dissolve in his teacup. Then, rather tentatively, he said,
I've got my own theory, you know. Separate from the books, I mean.
Samad bowed.
Please, enlighten us.
Don't get angry now, but just think for a minute. Why is a strict religious man like Pandey drinking bhang? Seriously, I know I tease you about it, but why is he?
You know my opinion on that. He isn't. He didn't. It was English propaganda.
And he was a good shot.
No doubt about it. A.S. Misra produces a copy of a record stating that Pandey trained in a special guard for 1 year, specially trained in the use of muskets.
Okay, so why does he miss? Why?
It is my belief that the only possible explanation is that the gun was faulty.
Yes, there is that. But maybe something else. Maybe he was being bullied into going out there and making a row, you know, goaded by the other guys. And he didn't want to kill anyone in the first place, you know. So he pretended to be drunk, so the boys in the barracks room would believe he missed the shot.
That is quite the stupidest theory I have ever heard, sighed Samad, as the second hand of Mickey's egg-stained clock started the 30-second countdown to midnight. The kind only you could come up with. It's absurd.
Why?
Why? Archibald, these Englishmen, these Captain Hearsays, Havelocks and the rest, were every Indian's mortal enemy. Why should he spare lives he despised?
Maybe he just couldn't do it. Maybe he wasn't the type.
Do you really believe there is a type of man who kills and a type of man who doesn't?
Maybe, Sam. Maybe not.
You sound like my wife, groaned Samad, mopping up a final piece of egg. Let me tell you something, Archibald. A man is a man is a man. His family threatened, his beliefs attacked, his way of life destroyed, his whole world coming to an end. He will kill. Make no mistake, he won't let the new order roll over him without a struggle. There will be people he will kill.
And there will be people he will save, said Archie Jones, with a cryptic look his friend would have thought an impossible feat for those sagging, chubby features. Trust me. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, Jamaica Irie,
said Denzel and Clarence, raising hot Irish coffees to each other in a toast, then immediately resuming round 9 of the dominoes.
Happy fucking New Year!
Bellowed Mickey from behind the counter.
Irie, 1990-1907. In this wrought-iron world of criss-cross cause and effect, could it be that the hidden throb I stole from them did not affect their future? Lolita, Vladimir Nabokov. 11. The Miseducation of Irie Jones. There was a lamppost, equidistant from the Jones House and Glenard Oak Comprehensive, that had begun to appear in Irie's dreams. Not the lamppost exactly, but a small, handmade advert which was sellotaped round its girth at eye level. It said, "Lose weight to earn money. 081-555-6752. Now, Irie Jones, aged 15, was big. The European proportions of Clara's figure had skipped a generation, and she was landed instead with Hortense's substantial Jamaican frame, loaded with pineapples, mangoes, and guavas. The girl had weight. Big tits, big butt, big hips, big thighs, big teeth. She was 13 stone and had £13 in her savings account. She knew she was the target audience. If ever there was one, she knew full well as she trudged schoolwards, mouth full of doughnut, hugging her spare tires, that the advert was speaking to her. It was speaking to her. Lose weight, it was saying, to earn money. You, Miss Jones, with your strategically placed arms and cardigan tied around the arse. The endless mystery, how to diminish that swollen enormity, the Jamaican posterior. With your belly-reducing knickers and breast-reducing bra, with your meticulous lycra-corseting, the much-lauded 90s answer to whalebone, with your elasticated waists. She knew the advert was talking to her. But she didn't know quite what it was saying. What were we talking about here? Sponsored slim? The earning capacity of thin people? Or something altogether more Jacobean, the brainchild of some sordid Wilsdon Shylock, a pound of flesh for a pound of gold, meat for money? Rapid eye movement. Sometimes she'd be walking through school in a bikini with the lamppost enigma written in chalk over her brown bulges, over her various ledges, shelf space for books, cups of tea, baskets, or, more to the point, children, bags of fruit, buckets of water. Ledges genetically designed with another country in mind, another climate. Other times, the sponsored slim dream. Knocking on door after door, butt naked with a clipboard, drenched in sunlight, trying to encourage old men to pinch an inch and pledge a pound. Worst times? Tearing off loose, white-flecked flesh and packing it into those old, curvaceous Coke bottles. She is carrying them to the corner shop, passing them over a counter, and Millat is the bindi-wearing, V-necked corner shopkeeper. He is adding them up, grudgingly opening the till with blood-stained paws, handing over the cash. A little Caribbean flesh for a little English change. Irie Jones was obsessed. Occasionally her worried mother cornered her in the hallway before she slunk out of the door, picked at her elaborate corsetry, asked, "What's up with you? What in the Lord's name are you wearing? How can you breathe?"
"Irie, my love, you're fine. You just built like an honest-to-God Bowden. Don't you know you're fine?"
But Irie didn't know she was fine. There was England, a gigantic mirror, and there was Irie, without reflection. A stranger in a stranger land. Nightmares and daydreams on the bus, in the bath, in class. Before, after, before, after, before, after. The mantra of the makeover junkie, sucking it in, letting it out, unwilling to settle for genetic fate, waiting instead for her transformation from Jamaican hourglass heavy with the sands that gather round Dun River Falls to English Rose. Oh. You know her. She's a slender, delicate thing, not made for the hot suns. A surfboard, rippled by the wave. Mrs. Olive Rudy, English teacher and expert doodle spotter at distances of up to 20 yards, reached over her desk to Irie's exercise book and tore out the piece of paper in question, looked dubiously at it, then inquired with melodious Scottish emphasis, "Before and after what?" What? Before and after what? Oh, nothing, miss. Nothing? Oh, come now, Miss Jones. No need for modesty. It is obviously more interesting than Sonnet 127. Nothing. It's nothing. Absolutely certain? You don't wish to delay the class any more? Because some of the class need to listen to Nay, are even a wee bit interested in what I have to say. So if you could spare some time from your doodling..." No one but no one said doodling like Olive Rudy. "And join the rest of us, we'll continue." "Well?" "Well what? Can you? Spare the time?" "Yes, Mrs. Rudy." "Oh, good. That's cheered me up. Sonnet 127, please."
"In the old age, black was not counted fair," continued Francis Stone in the catatonic drone with which students read Elizabethan verse. "Or if it were, it bore not beauty's name." Irie put her right hand on her stomach, sucked in and tried to catch Millat's eye. But Millat was busy showing pretty Nicky Tyler how he could manipulate his tongue into a narrow roll, a flute. Nicky Tyler was showing him how the lobes of her ears were attached to the side of her head rather than loose. Flirtatious remnants of this morning's science lesson, inherited characteristics, part 1, A. Loose, attached, rolled, flat, blue eye, brown eye, before, after. "Therefore my mistress's eyes are raven black, her brows so suited, and they mourners seem. My mistress's eyes are nothing like the sun. Coral is far more red than her lips red. If snow be white, why then her breasts are dun." Puberty.
Real, full-blown puberty, not the slight mound of a breast or the shadowy emergence of fuzz, had separated these old friends, Irie Jones and Milat Iqbal. Different sides of the school fence. Irie believed she had been dealt the dodgy cards, mountainous curves, buck teeth, and thick metal retainer, impossible afro hair, and to top it off, molish eyesight, which in turn required bottle-top spectacles in a light shade of pink. Even those blue eyes, the eyes Archie had been so excited about, lasted 2 weeks only. She had been born with them, yes, but one day Clara looked again and there were brown eyes staring up at her, like the transition between a closed bud and an open flower, the exact moment of which the naked, waiting eye can never detect. And this belief in her ugliness, in her wrongness, had subdued her. She kept her smart-ass comments to herself these days. She kept her right hand on her stomach. She was all wrong. Whereas Milat was like youth remembered in the nostalgic eyeglass of old age, beauty parodying itself, broken Roman nose, tall, thin, lightly veined, smoothly muscled, chocolate eyes with a reflective green sheen like moonlight bouncing off a dark sea, irresistible smile, big white teeth. In Glenard Oak Comprehensive, black, Pakistani, Greek, Irish, these were races, but those with sex appeal lapped the other runners. They were a species all of their own. If hairs be wires, black wires grow on her head. She loved him, of course. But he used to say to her, "Thing is, people rely on me. They need me to be Milat, good old Milat, wicked Milat, safe, sweet as Milat. They need me to be cool. It's practically a responsibility." And it practically was. Ringo Starr once said of the Beatles that they were never bigger than they were in Liverpool, late 1962. They just got more countries. And that's how it was for Milat. He was so big in Cricklewood, in Willesden, in West Hampstead, the summer of 1990, that nothing he did later in his life could top it. From his first Ragistani crowd, he had expanded and developed tribes throughout the school, throughout North London. He was simply too big to remain merely the object of Irie's affection, leader of the Ragistanis, or the son of Samad and Alsana Iqbal. He had to please all of the people all of the time. To the Cockney wide boys in the white jeans and the coloured shirts, he was the joker, the risk-taker, respected lady-killer. To the black kids, he was fellow weed-smoker and valued customer. To the Asian kids, hero and spokesman. Social chameleon. And underneath it all, there remained an ever-present anger and hurt, the feeling of belonging nowhere that comes to people who belong everywhere. It was this soft underbelly that made him most beloved, most adored by Irie and the nice, oboe-playing, long-skirted middle-class girls, most treasured by these hair-flicking and fugue-singing females. He was their dark prince, occasional lover or impossible crush, the subject of sweaty fantasy and ardent dreams. And he was also their project. What was to be done about Milat? He simply must stop smoking weed. We have to try and stop him walking out of class. They worried about his attitude at sleepovers, discussed his education hypothetically with their parents. Just say there was this Indian boy, yeah, who was always getting into, even wrote poems on the subject. Girls either wanted him or wanted to improve him, but most often a combination of the two. They wanted to improve him until he justified the amount they wanted him. Everybody's bit of rough. Milat Iqbal. "But you're different," Milat Iqbal would say to the martyr Irie Jones. "You're different. We go way back. We've got history. You're a real friend. They don't really mean anything to me." Irie liked to believe that they had history, that she was different in a good way.
"Thy blackest, fairest in my judgment's place."
Mrs. Rudy silenced Francis with a raised finger. "Now, what is he saying there? Annalise?" Annalise Hirsch, who had spent the lesson so far plaiting red and yellow thread into her hair, looked up in blank confusion. "Anything, Annalise, dear? Any little idea, no matter how small, no matter how paltry?" Annalise bit her lip, looked at the book, looked at Mrs. Rudy, looked at the book. Black is good? Yes. Well, I suppose we can add that to last week's contribution. Hamlet is mad? Anybody else? What about this? For since each hand hath put on nature's power, fearing the foul with art's false borrowed face. What might that mean, I wonder? Joshua Chalfin, the only kid in class who volunteered opinions, put his hand up. Yes, Joshua. Make up. Yes, said Mrs. Rudy, looking close to orgasm. Yes, Joshua. That's it. What about it? She's got a dark complexion which she's trying to lighten by means of makeup, artifice. The Elizabethans were very keen on a pale skin. They would have loved you then, sneered Millat, for Joshua was pasty, practically anemic, curly-haired and chubby. You would have been Tom Bloody Cruise. Laughter. Not because it was funny, but because it was Millat putting a nerd where a nerd should be, in his place. One more word from you, Mr. Iqbal, and you are out. Shakespeare. Sweaty. Bollocks. That's three. Don't worry, I let myself out. This was the kind of thing Millat did so expertly. The door slammed. The nice girls looked at each other in that way. He's just so out of control, so crazy. He really needs some help, some close one-to-one personal help from a good friend. The boys belly laughed. The teacher wondered if this was the beginning of a mutiny. Irie covered her stomach with her right hand. Marvellous. Very adult. I suppose Millat Iqbal is some kind of hero. Mrs. Rudy, looking round the gormless faces of 5F, saw for the first time and with dismal clarity that this was exactly what he was. Does anyone else have anything to say about these sonnets? Miss Jones, will you stop looking mournfully at the door? He's gone, all right? Unless you'd like to join him. No, Mrs. Rudy. All right, then. Have you anything to say about the sonnets? Yes. What? Is she black? Is who black? The dark lady. No, dear. She's dark. She's not black in the modern sense. There weren't any, well, Afro-Caribbeans in England at that time, dear. That's more a modern phenomenon, as I'm sure you know. But this was the 1600s. I mean, I can't be sure, but it does seem terribly unlikely. Unless she was a slave of some kind, and he's unlikely to have written a series of sonnets to a lord and then a slave, is he? Irie reddened. She had thought, just then, that she had seen something like a reflection, but it was receding, so she said, "Don't know, miss." Besides, he says very clearly, "In nothing art thou black, save in thy deeds." No, dear, she just has a dark complexion. You see, as dark as mine, probably. Irie looked at Mrs. Rudy. She was the colour of strawberry mousse. You see, Joshua is quite right. The preference was for women to be excessively pale in those days. The sonnet is about the debate between her natural colouring and the makeup that was the fashion of the time. I just thought, like when he says, here, then will I swear beauty herself is black, and the curly hair thing, black wires. Irie gave up in the face of giggling and shrugged. No, dear, you're reading it with a modern ear. Never read what is old with a modern ear. In fact, that will serve as today's principle. Can you all write that down, please? 5F wrote that down. And the reflection that Irie had glimpsed slunk back into the familiar darkness. On the way out of class, Irie was passed a note by Annalise Hirsch, who shrugged to signify that she was not the author, but merely one of many handlers. It said, "By William Shakespeare. Ode to Letitia and all my kinky-haired, big-ass bitches." the cryptically named PK's Afro Hair, Design and Management, sat between Fairweather Funeral Parlour and Rakshan Dentists, the convenient proximity meaning it was not at all uncommon for a cadaver of African origin to pass through all three establishments on his or her final journey to an open casket. So when you phoned for a hair appointment, and Andrea or Denise or Jackie told you 3:30 Jamaican time, naturally it meant come late, but there was also a chance it meant that some stone-cold church-going lady was determined to go to her grave with long fake nails and a weave on. Strange as it sounds, there are plenty of people who refuse to meet the Lord with an afro. Irie, ignorant of all this, turned up for her appointment 3:30 on the dot, intent upon transformation, intent upon fighting her genes, a headscarf disguising the bird's nest of her hair, her right hand carefully placed upon her stomach.
You want something, Pickney?
Straight hair. Straight, straight, long, black, sleek, flickable, tossable, shakeable, touchable, finger-throughable, wind-blowable hair. With a fringe. 3:30, was all Irie managed to convey of this. With Andrea.
Andrea's next door,
replied the woman, pulling at a piece of elongated gum and nodding in the direction of Fairweather's.
Having fun with the dearly departed. You better come sit down and wait and don't bother me. Don't know how long she'll be.
Irie looked lost, standing in the middle of the shop, clutching her chub. The woman took pity, swallowed her gum, and looked Irie up and down. She felt more sympathetic as she noted Irie's cocoa complexion, the light eyes.
Jackie.
Irie.
Pale, sir. Freckles and everything. You Mexican?
No.
Arab?
Half Jamaican, half English.
Half caste,
Jackie explained patiently.
Your mom white?
Dad. Jackie wrinkled her nose.
Usually the other way around. How curly is it? Let me see what's under there.
She made a grab for Irie's headscarf. Irie, horrified at the possibility of being laid bare in a room full of people, got there before her and held on tight. Jackie sucked her teeth.
What do you expect us to do with it if we can't see it?
Irie shrugged. Jackie shook her head, amused.
You ain't been in before?
No, never.
What is it you want?
Straight, said Irie firmly, thinking of Nicky Tyler. Straight and dark red.
Is that a fact? You wash your hair recent?
Yesterday, said Irie, offended. Jackie slapped her upside her head.
Don't wash it. If you want it straight, don't wash it. You ever have ammonia on your head? It's like the devil's having a party on your scalp. You're crazy. Don't wash it for 2 weeks and then come back.
But Irie didn't have 2 weeks. She had it all planned. She was going to go round to Millat's this very evening with her new mane, all tied up in a bun, and she was going to take off her glasses and shake down her hair, and he was going to say, "Why, Miss Jones, I never would have supposed. Why, Miss Jones, you're..."
"I have to do it today. My sister's getting married."
"Well,
when Andrea get back, she's going to burn 7 shades of shit out of your hair, and you'll be lucky if you don't walk out of here with a bald head."
"But then it's your funeral."
"Here,"
she said, thrusting a pile full of magazines into Irie's hands.
"There,"
she said, pointing to a chair. PK's was split into 2 halves, male and female. In the male section, as relentless ragga came unevenly over a battered stereo, young boys had logos cut into the back of their heads at the hands of slightly older boys, skillful wielders of the electric trimmers. Adidas. Bad Mother. Martin. The male section was all laughter, all talk, all play. There was an easiness that sprang from no male haircut ever costing over £6 or taking more than 15 minutes. It was a simple enough exchange, and there was joy in it. The buzz of the revolving blade by your ear, a rough brush down with a warm hand, mirrors front and back to admire the transformation. You came in with a picky head, uneven and coarse, disguised underneath a baseball cap, and you left swiftly afterwards a new man, smelling sweetly of coconut oil and with a cut as sharp and clean as a swear word. In comparison, the female section of PKs was a deathly thing. Here, the impossible desire for straightness and movement fought daily with the stubborn determination of the curved African follicle. Here, ammonia, hot combs, clips, pins and simple fire had all been enlisted in the war and were doing their damnedest to beat each curly hair into submission.
"Is it straight?"
was the only question you heard as the towels came off and the heads emerged from the dryer pulsating with pain.
"Is it straight, Denise? Tell me, is it straight, Jackie?"
To which Jackie or Denise, having none of the obligations of white hairdressers, no need to make tea or kiss arse, flatter or make conversation, for these were not customers they were dealing with but desperate, wretched patients, would give a sceptical snort and whip off the puke-green gown.
"It's as straight as it's ever going to be."
Four women sat in front of Irie now, biting their lips, staring intently into a long, dirty mirror, waiting for their straighter selves to materialise. While Irie flicked nervously through American black hair magazines, the four women sat grimacing in pain. Occasionally one would say to another, "How long?" To which the proud reply came, 15 minutes. "How long for you?" 22. This shit's been on my head 22 minutes. It better be straight. It was a competition in agony, like rich women in posh restaurants ordering ever smaller salads. Finally, there would come a scream or a,
"That's it, shit, I can't take it."
And the head in question was rushed to the sink, where the washing could never be quick enough. You cannot get ammonia out of your hair quick enough. And the quiet weeping began. It was at this point that animosity arose. Some people's hair was kinkier than others. Some afros fought harder, some survived. And the animosity spread from fellow customer to hairdresser to inflictor of this pain, for it was natural enough to suspect Jackie or Denise of something like sadism. Their fingers were too slow as they worked the stuff out. The water seemed to trickle instead of gush. And meanwhile, the devil had a high old time burning the crap out of your hairline.
"Is it straight? Jackie, is it straight?"
The boys arched their heads round the partition wall. Irie looked up from her magazine. There was little to say. They all came out straight or straight enough. But they also came out dead, dry, splintered, stiff, all the spring gone, like the hair of a cadaver as the moisture seeps away. Jackie or Denise, knowing full well that the curved African follicle will, in the end, follow its genetic instructions, put a philosophic slant on the bad news.
"It's as straight as it ever going to be. 3 weeks if you're lucky."
Despite the obvious failure of the project, each woman along the line felt that it would be different for her, that when their own unveiling came, straight, straight, flickable, wind-blowable locks would be theirs. Irie, as full of confidence as the rest, returned to her magazine.
"Malika, vibrant young star of the smash hit sitcom Malika's Life, explains how she achieves her loose and flowing look. I hot wrap it each evening, ensuring that the ends are lightly waxed in African queen afro sheen. Then, in the morning, I put a comb on the stove for approximately..."
The return of Andrea. The magazine was snatched from her hands, her headscarf unceremoniously removed before she could stop it, and 5 long and eloquent fingernails began to work their way through her scalp.
"Ooh," murmured Andrea.
This sign of approval was a rare enough occurrence for the rest of the shop to come round the partition to have a look.
"Ooh,"
said Denise, adding her fingers to Andrea's.
"So loose."
An older lady, wincing with pain underneath a dryer, nodded admiringly.
"Such a loose curl,"
cooed Jackie, ignoring her own scolded patient to reach into Irie's wool.
"That's half-caste hair for you. I wish mine were like that. That'll relax beautiful."
Irie screwed up her face.
"I hate it." "She hates it," said Denise to the crowd. "It's light brown in places." "I've been dealing with a corpse all morning. Be nice to get my hands into something soft,"
said Andrea, emerging from her reverie.
"You gonna relax it, darling?"
"Yes, straight, straight and red." Andrea tied a green gown round Irie's neck and lowered her into a swiveling chair.
"Don't know about red, baby. Can't die and relax on the same day. Kill the hair dead. But I can do the relax for you, no problem.
should come out beautiful, darling.
The communication between hairdressers and PKs being poor, no one told Andrea that Irie had washed her hair. 2 minutes after having the thick white ammonia gloop spread onto her head, she felt the initial cold sensation change to a terrific fire. There was no dirt there to protect the scalp, and Irie started screaming.
I just put it on. You want it straight, don't you? Stop making that noise. But it hurts. Life hurts, said Andrea scornfully. Beauty hurts.
Irie bit her tongue for another 30 seconds until blood appeared above her right ear. Then the poor girl blacked out. She came to with her head over the sink, watching her hair, which was coming out in clumps, shimmy down the plug hole.
You should have told me,
Andrea was grumbling.
You should have told me that you washed it. It's got to be dirty first. Now look.
Now look. Hair that had once come down to her mid-vertebrae was only a few inches from her head.
See what you've done,
continued Andrea, as Irie wept openly.
I'd like to know what Mr. Parley King is going to say about this. I better phone him and see if we can fix this up for you for free.
Mr. Paul King, the PK in question, owned the place. He was a big white guy in his mid-50s who had been an entrepreneur in the building trade until Black Wednesday and his wife's credit card excesses took away everything but some bricks and mortar. Looking for a new idea, he read in the lifestyle section of his breakfast paper that black women spend 5 times as much as white women on beauty products and 9 times as much on their hair. Taking his wife, Sheila, as an archetypal white woman, Paul King began to salivate. A little more research in his local library uncovered a multi-million pound industry. Paul King then bought a disused butcher's on Wilson High Road, headhunted Andrea from a Harleston salon, and gave black hairdressing a shot. It was an instant success. He was amazed to discover that women on low income were indeed prepared to spend hundreds of pounds per month on their hair, and yet more on nails and accessories. He was vaguely amused when Andrea first explained to him that physical pain was also part of the process. And the best part of it was there was no question of suing. They expected the burns. Perfect business.
Go on, Andrea, love. Give her a freebie,
said Paul King, shouting on a brick-shaped mobile over the construction noise of his new salon opening in Wembley.
But don't make a habit of it.
Andrea returned to Irie with the good tidings.
It's all right, darling. This one's on us.
But what? Irie stared at her Hiroshima reflection.
What can you... Put your scarf back on, turn left out of here and go down the high road until you get to a shop called Roshi's Hair Care. Take this card and tell them PK sent you. Get 8 packs of number 5 type black hair with a red glow and come back here quick style.
Hair, repeated Irie through snot and tears.
Fake hair. Stupid girl, it's not fake, it's real. And when it's on your head, it'll be your real hair. Go!
Blubbing like a baby, Irie shuffled out of PK's and down the high road, trying to avoid her reflection in the shop windows. Reaching Roshi's, she did her best to pull herself together, put her right hand over her stomach, and pushed through the doors. It was dark in Roshi's and smelt strongly of the same scent as PK's. Ammonia and coconut oil, pain mixed with pleasure. From the dim glow given off by a flickering strip light, Irie could see there were no shelves to speak of, but instead hair products piled like mountains from the floor up, while accessories, combs, bands, nail varnish, were stapled to the walls with the price written in felt tip alongside. The only display of any recognizable kind was placed just below the ceiling in a loop around the room, taking pride of place like a collection of sacrificial scalps or hunting trophies. Hair. Long tresses stapled a few inches apart. Underneath each, a large cardboard sign explaining its pedigree. 2 meters. Natural Thai, straight, chestnut. 1 meter. Natural Pakistani, straight with a wave, black. 5 meters. Natural Chinese, straight, black. 3 meters. Synthetic hair, corkscrew curl, pink. Irie approached the counter. A hugely fat woman in a sari was waddling to the cash till and back again. to hand over £25 to an Indian girl whose hair had been shorn haphazardly close to the scalp.
"And please don't be looking at me in that manner. 25 is very reasonable price. I tell you, I can't do any more with all these split ends."
The girl objected in another language, picked up the bag.